Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and now we're in-depth inside the Obama White House. Sometimes Washington, D.C. can feel like the same old backslappy white bro club filled with old-school government hacks. They consider a career impressive if you've worked for several administrations, not if you've been on a campaign that had accomplished something that many people believed was impossible. That was Alyssa Mastromonaco's read of the situation as she transitioned from then-Senator Obama's office in Chicago to the White House. She worked as deputy scheduler for John Kerry's presidential campaign, briefly for Bernie Sanders, and then for Barack Obama. When she left the White House, she left as Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Assistant to the President. In her new memoir, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea?, Mastromonaco dishes behind the scenes on an historic presidency, self-deprecates her own role, and offers advice about politics and leadership for young people, adding, she wants these young hopefuls to feel less alone, less weird, less anxious, and more confident. Alyssa Mastromonaco joins me today from New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So that's a tall order for a memoir.
It is. I thought that it would be great if we could just do something that was a little bit different than all of the other memoirs that had come before it.
I do want to get back to that good old boy network that I sort of alluded to at the top there. You acknowledge that most political memoirs are written by men because most people who work in politics are men. They're usually preoccupied with legacy. Why do you think women aren't as concerned with legacy?
Because I think that we're always a little bit forward-looking and not so much backwards-looking. And so I think that when I feel like some of my friends in the White House or people who I'd known in Washington, when they left the White House, it's like you assume that's going to be the greatest thing you ever do. And so you want your place in history to sort of be cemented. And for me, I was, 38 years old when I left the White House. I'd had an incredible ride. And I thought that that there were so many other women who deserved the same opportunities and exposure and experiences that I had. And so I wanted to write something that was just super accessible and showed people that, like, you, one, can have a place in history, but you can also make that history and that legacy accessible for other people and not make it seem like, you passed healthcare on your own.
Legacy is kind of a big word for a lot of people to wrap their head around, especially at 38, right?
Yes. I mean, I was hoping that, you have a humility and you're like, okay, so this is probably one of the most important things I'm ever going to do, but you hope it's like not the last interesting thing you ever do. So,
right.
At least the book was was my next interesting endeavor.
Well, it certainly doesn't stop people at 38 from saying, I need to analyze my legacy anyway.
No, absolutely. And I just, there were so many, and if I like looked at my legacy, I would say that one of the most important things I did was leave a bunch of much younger people who worked for me with greater opportunities than they came in with. They all left with better skills, better managers. And so I think I just sort of have maybe even a different view of my legacy.
You know, President Obama, up until just recently, he'd been lounging around on yachts. Is he thinking about his legacy?
You know, how can he not think about, 8 years of work where I think that every single person that I worked with, we all wanted to do what was right by the country. And, you always kind of think that every Republican, Democrat, everybody thinks that they're doing right by America. And, for him to have tried so hard and then sort of see the dismantling of a government that we worked in, that we worked for no reason, really, not even a philosophical reason or the philosophy right now, I guess, is just undo everything Obama did and let's not even think about it, critically or think if there are things to keep. Like when we came in, when we transitioned from the Bush administration, they were so helpful. They were so gracious. They helped us more than I ever could have dreamed. And because of that, we looked at all of the things that they had done and we're like, you know what? There's a lot of really good stuff here. And so we should keep it. And unfortunately, in terms of Barack Obama's legacy, it's unfortunate that I think there's a person in the White House right now whose only goal is to dismantle it for no good reason.
Well, but actually, does he have the capability to really dismantle his legacy? I mean, when you think about what he truly accomplished in terms of transforming the way we think about race in this country, for example, or what's possible for this country to accomplish. I mean,
so
we never thought it
so.
Was. Yeah, right. So is it really possible?
So I hope that it is not possible. But I do think that when you look at the juxtaposition of, you know, a generation of children who were born and would never know a time when there wasn't an African-American president, right? And now they're all old enough and they see our current president who spews hate. So I hope it can't be undone. I do think that there can be damage done.
One of the things you do in the book that I really like is you boil down these tidbits that you've learned about leadership, either from people around you or things you sort of figured out on your own. One of the things you said is you be prepared to defend your choices. In other words, don't pass the buck. But by my lights, sitting here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, isn't that what Washington, D.C. does best?
It does, 100%. It's always somebody else's fault. There's so much finger pointing. The thing that I would say I'm proud of and the lesson I learned working for Barack Obama is that even if Congress or pundits or anybody was doing that on the outside, inside those walls of the West Wing, we did not do that. If you had a decision, if you had an idea, if you wanted to execute it, if you could get, you know, some consensus behind it and it didn't work out, one, the president would be happy that we got together, we had a plan. Maybe it doesn't always work out. And he was very sort of understanding about that. But also, if the plan went up in a ball of flames and you walked into the Oval Office and you said, sir, I know we talked you into this idea, it didn't really work, and here's why, he'd be like, okay, do better next time. There wasn't this, we weren't pointing fingers because we never thought that we were going to, like, quote unquote, get in trouble. You know, Barack Obama was, there are like a lot of politicians and even people out there, if you do something wrong, they kind of ice you out, right? You get put in timeout and you're like, God, I never want to be in timeout again. And so you do things to protect yourself. Barack Obama didn't run that kind of White House. And so if you did something wrong, you could go in, tell him how, learn from it, and move on. There wasn't this sort of like long-term damage done, unless you lied about something, which I don't remember anybody doing. But that was the one thing he wouldn't tolerate. Like, there was no not being truthful. If you were truthful and you messed up, kind of it is what it is. But I think in D.C., people are just always playing the blame game, and the president didn't let us do that in the West Wing. So it was a much more collaborative, sort of progressive environment.
Still, being prepared to defend your choices is a seasoned skill. I can't imagine as a young person you went in with that.
No. There are the one thing that you learn, especially when we were going through the campaign in 2007 and 2008, you know, Barack Obama and David Plouffe wanted to run a very different campaign. And, you know, the standard sort of, if you look back, you know, president or presidential campaigns or candidates, they do all of the sort of standard Democratic Party dinners. And the president said, or then Senator Obama said, those people are going to vote for a Democrat. You know, whether it's me, whether it's Hillary, you know, are those really the people that we should be talking to? Shouldn't we be talking to the people who are less likely to vote, who definitely don't know who I am? And so through that lens, the decisions were quite hard. And you have to go back to sort of the foundations of you know, the Democratic establishment and say, sorry, we're not going to do it this way. And here's why. And so we built the case, and then we won. And so I think that through that whole process, we all developed a sort of thicker skin. We knew people weren't necessarily going to agree with us, but we always had a reason for why we were doing what we were doing. The answer was never because that's how they've always done it or that's how it always gets done. That was the worst thing that you could say to Barack Obama. And so when we got into the White House, there are so many things that you have to choose between. There are so many different ways that you can plan a trip, so many ways you can go on a foreign trip. So, and it's a post 9/11 world. So the opportunities and how you could communicate were more difficult. They were, you know, there it's not as easy when you're being protected a little with more rigor, I guess. But so when we would go through our decision making process, it was, we were all supportive enough that you could actually have critical thinking and come out with what you thought. The environment that we had was very conducive to honing your critical thinking skills, because you could actually disagree with someone or poke a hole in their idea in what Barack Obama would call disagreeing without being disagreeable. So building the case, defending the case, and being able to support your case was much easier because you felt like it was pretty considered, that you had, you know, alignment for the most part by your peers in the West Wing. And, you know, it was still your idea, though. So you could go in and pitch it as yours, but say that, you know, other people supported it and that we modified it in this way and that way. So that was, I would say, I didn't walk in with it. I had a decent foundation, but it was, you know, sort of our structure in the West Wing that definitely helped me, like, focus and sharpen that skill.
It all sounds very smooth. It all sounds very Pollyanna, like it just was working so well. I can't believe it all worked well all the time. I gotta believe there were that, you know, out of the gate at least, things were rough.
Of course.
So let's imagine you're in the White House, you know, ideology aside right now, there are growing pains happening before our eyes right now in the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to get to a point, I would assume, where things will be working more smoothly, right?
You would hope so. The big difference that I see, which is, and let me be honest, I would like to say that the way we tried to work together was maybe a little bit on the Pollyanna-ish side. It's not that we did not have hard times or that we did not make big mistakes. But the thing about the difference I saw between us at this stage and the Trump administration right now is that we all had very clearly defined roles. And it eliminates, look, of all the things that you are challenged by in your first 100 days or your first 6 months, the one thing we weren't challenged by was knowing who was supposed to do what. And right now, you know, you see in a time of crisis, there is no time when that is more important than in a time of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you need to sort of stand up your response team or you need to sort of crash on something, it's very helpful to know who's in charge of what. Things come together much quicker. But in the Trump administration right now, I think that they really need to spend some time sussing out exactly who does what all of the senior advisors do. And I do think that things will smooth out for them, because right now they need to nominate more people. They need to fill more spots in the government. I just think that their focus is a little bit different than ours was. Ours was really like, let's learn, because we didn't know. Very few of us had worked in the White House ever before. It was learn what to do and then sort of put your spin on it. But you had to fundamentally understand how things functioned.
Getting back to this notion of learning from our leaders, I mean, realistically, you can learn from a bad leader. I mean, there are things I've learned from really bad leaders that I've had in throughout my life and my career, just as you can learn from a good leader. What have you learned from Barack Obama, both? I know you probably won't tell me on the bad side, but good and bad.
The good is that I think that he is, in terms of how he treated all of us, he was really respectful. He was intellectually curious and sort of, you know, encouraged the same in us. And, you know, he was just a good, nice person. You know, on the bad side, you know, I would say that he, in terms of like managing personnel, that was not really his strong suit. And at one point, it was sometime in the middle of, I think it was the first term. And he said to me, I said, well, you know, I had an idea. And I said, well, you know, I want to go back and just talk to the chief of staff about it first, and then I'll come back to you. And he said, but you report to me. I was like, no, I don't. I report to the chief of staff. Like, that's how organizations work. And so since he had never been in a truly hierarchical organization before, if you, you know, think about it, that, you know, that was probably a little bit of a, that was a little bit of a, like, learning curve that, you know, we really wanted to work within a structure so that when he got something, an idea, it had been, you know, pretty vetted. So I would say that, like, in management, he was not, like, in terms of, in, you know, like, the group of us, he was maybe, like, that wasn't his strong suit.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Alyssa Mastromonaco, author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea, her new memoir. You can join the conversation by tweeting me at Tiffany Hansen. That's Hansen with two S's, E-N. Tell me what you think makes a good leader. What have you learned about leadership? Tweet me, Tiffany Hansen, at Tiffany Hansen, H-A-N-S-S-E-N. Alyssa, you said also in your book that persistence will get you far and that leaders have to champion the push. I think some of President Obama's detractors would say he didn't necessarily do that, that he was no drama Obama, that he was somebody who led from behind. He apologized for the U.S. How did his persistence really pay off for him in the end, do you think?
Wow. I would think that I don't think that he led from behind. I do think that the no drama Obama thing was not about us not challenging each other. It was about us not, you know, someone doesn't get their way. Guess what? Pendulum, as politics is a pendulum. It swings back and forth. There's a winner, there's a loser. You don't always get your way, even when you're making policy. And so it was more that he expected us to respect ourselves and our colleagues enough that we wouldn't go running to the press and trash talk someone if we didn't get our way and try to indict them and say, oh, you know, this economic policy is terrible, you know, on background to the Washington Post, when what you're really doing is not hurting that person, you're hurting the whole administration. And so that was really when people say no drama Obama, I feel that it's not that he was afraid of conflict. He just didn't feel like we should shoot ourselves in the foot and, you know, war things out in the press on background, which is just like, you know, not super heroic. But on the world stage, I mean, I think it's pretty hard to say that he did not have good relationships with, you know, all of the other foreign leaders, and that they didn't respect him and that he wasn't able to bring people together. So, you know, that's sort of my perspective.
I want to talk about John Kerry a little bit. Do you tell me about his campaign slogans? Do you remember?
So, oh, I do. There was stronger at home, more respected in the world, the raw deal, the real deal express, the sea to shining sea, sea to shining sea, believe in America tour.
I just like to imagine being the person who has to repaint the buses every single time.
Yes, that's a real thing.
Right.
Yes, that is a real thing. And it is actually one of the things that I brought to David Plouffe when we started the Obama campaign, which was like, this is how we piss away money on the Kerry campaign. By changing, you'd be surprised, you change your banner the night before.
Right.
It's $10,000 to get a banner shipped overnight, man. You know, with a new slogan on it. And so, no, I think there was a belief that, you know, the slogan was somehow going to be magic, that if you kept changing it, you'd find the right one and it would help you win. And because I think there was a little bit of a problem with John Kerry connecting with people, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't win, but it was more about like him not being able to connect with people than it was about like the slogans and the podium signs and the mm-hmm. placards.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about him not winning, actually, because having been on both sides, not winning and winning. I mean, obviously, when you don't win, that sucks. It feels terrible. Mm-hmm. But you really do pour a lot of yourself. A lot of people pour a lot of themselves into this.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 24 hours, you really have to pick yourself up.
Yep.
And you need a job.
Get back to it.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do you do that?
So it's awful.
Right.
It is it is exactly that. And one of my sort of most vivid memories is that, which is why I don't believe in exit polls ever, is that we were believing the exit polls and we were winning. And so we started prematurely celebrating. And by the time, you know, the sort of hit the fan, we were drunk and we mm-hmm. had to pull it together and realize that we needed to get a venue for a concession speech the next day. And so your adrenaline kind of carries you through that. You know, you have to be there for your boss, like you have to make it the best that it can possibly be. And then it's over and you are just wrecked. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully if you know you're lucky, the campaign, there's like a little severance for you. If not, and it's something that I never expected, but in Washington, D.C., after the Kerry campaign, there was an actual dedicated unemployment line at the unemployment office for Kerry Edwards' campaign staff. And you walk in and you're just like, my God, like, is this what it is? And, you know, when you're in Washington, too, which is why I recommend no campaign ever run it out of Washington, because it's just like all these people are there now and they're just like sitting around and they're depressed and they're day drinking. Whereas at least if you're someplace else, you know, everybody sort of scatters and gets themselves back together a little quicker, I think. But no. And everyone because people don't make a lot of money on campaigns. So it's not like you can just sit on your cush savings account and be like, oh, I'm just going to take time off and travel. Usually you have to, you know, take jobs. And a lot of times the worst part of it is you've spent so much time working on something you believe so passionately about. And then a lot of times you have to take a job that you really don't care about just because you need to get back in the workforce. You know, you don't want to be unemployed too long. And you're like, well, this job is better than no job. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it even kind of compounds the depression that you feel because you go from such a high feeling so connected. And now you're sort of like just phoning it in every day at work. Mm-hmm. But then you get back at it. Things come together.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things you mentioned in the book about leadership skills you've learned is when you're reasonable, savvy, and polite, you get far. I'd like to add that I know plenty of people who got a lot farther in life than me by being none of those things. So I'm going to challenge you on that.
Okay. No, you totally can. And let me say that from my perspective, if I had been a backstabbing, spiteful, mean, opportunist, I might be even further, but I would not be happier. And so I feel like all of the things I did made me those characteristics made me successful in the way I wanted to be successful, which was being a leader to me was about bringing people together and getting the best result and presenting it as such, not me hogging credit for everything and trying to be this sort of like autocrat in my own department. And you know, if you, in my view, if you sort of embrace what I felt, which was like, you know, savvy and thoughtful, when you make a mistake, people are more willing to forgive you. When you need help, people are more willing to help you. And when you sort of go on this, like, you know, opportunistic, mean, bullish way, yeah, you can do that and you can get further. But the minute that you hit a bump, who's there to help you? And so I just always liked my way of doing it better. It's just a little bit more comforting.
But I have this vision of Washington, D.C. as being filled with you're doing this, but you're sitting in a room filled with those people. You're sitting in a room filled with those type of autocratic jerks who are looking at you trying to be that nice, reasonable, savvy, polite person.
So I would say, though, and you're not going to like this, you're going to say I'm being Pollyanna, but in the rooms that I sat in, there weren't that many people. It's why it was almost easy for me to be the way I was. On the outside, like when you left, when you were in like the Washington in quotes, yes, there are those people for whom power is the penultimate. But in that West Wing for the time when I was there, that wasn't it. I think that we all had enough self-awareness to know that we needed each other. So we didn't really have that vibe. And I don't think that there are any press reports to really account to say that we were, you know, that there was that type of person in the West Wing. Boy, not saying everyone was easy. I mean, everyone knows Rahm Emanuel. He is Mayor Emanuel is one of my dear friends, but like he is not a shrinking violet. He definitely, you know, would blow up and have his moments. But, you know, it wasn't because he was trying to be this autocrat. It's because he was trying to, you know, get a lot done and bring us all together and have us like marching in the same direction. Being the first chief of staff, I will say this. I do not envy Reince Priebus. Being the first chief of staff is definitely, I think, the hardest.
Alyssa Mastromonaco worked as deputy chief scheduler for John Kerry's presidential campaign, briefly for Bernie Sanders,
And then for Barack Obama, when she left the White House, she was Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Assistant to the President. Her new memoir is called Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? She joined me from New York.